Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. OU Israel presents...
In. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. And this show is for Shabbat Parshat Mishpatim. Really, it's HaMishpatim. I'll mention that in a moment. And recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 22nd of Shvat, 5771, Kaf Bet Shvat. And in the secular calendar, January 27th. Interestingly, today is Holocaust Memorial Day in various countries around the world, not officially in Israel. Our Holocaust Memorial Day, Yom HaShoah, is in the end of the month of Nisan, which is usually in April sometime. But it should be known that there are countries that are marking a Holocaust Memorial Day today, January 27th. This Shabbat, in addition to reading Parshat Mishpatim, it is also Rosh Chodesh benching, Shabbat Mevorachim, of Adar Rishon, the first of two Adars. I would like to talk about that also. Maybe I will shortly. And in the meantime, let us say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tihyena aznecha kashuvot lekol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yoh Adonai miya amod, ki imacha hasalicha lema'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi, velidvoro hochalti. Nafshi ladonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed veharbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umeyafela laora, umishibud lugeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar amen. Have to remember the different things that I wanted to mention now. Let's start at something that came to mind earlier. The opening of the show these last many months has been the Torah reading of the first verse, occasionally the first two verses of the weekly reading. This week, Mishpatim, a very short pasuk, but you heard it already. This is followed by a violin piece, about a 12-second clip, than I have been putting in the last number of weeks. I don't remember, I don't think I explained it. I was kind of inviting people to email me, so you could do that at tt@ou.org, and tell me if that particular musical clip brings a certain association to mind. If I don't hear from anyone, then next week, Emir Tzashem, Bali Neder, I will mention what it is. That's followed by a churning sound, which I recorded from the printing machine that prints most of Torah Tidbits in-house, and I felt that that should be part of Torah Tidbits Audio's introduction. That is followed by the creaky door of E.G. Marshall and Radio Mystery Theater, CBS Radio Mystery Theater, a show that I liked very much in the past and a show that I have heard over the last number of years from a set of four CDs that had the entire series. It's what got me back into old radio, and I'll just mention briefly, there's a website, www.decoderringtheater.com. Theater is spelled R-E. It's from Canada, decoderringtheater, one word, .com. And they have new radio shows in the style of old radio. It's wonderful because you have a lot of the Bob and Ray spoof of the old genre while you have engaging and serious, engaging stories, which are pretty good, but the banter between the characters, it mostly is two series, one called The Red Panda, Canada's number one superhero, and his sidekick, the Flying Squirrel, and the other is Black Jacket Justice, and his partner, Tracy Dixon, Girl Detective, and it just drips with cliches and sarcastic comments, and it's a lot of fun. Downloading from there, very easy for your MP3, and I recommend it. Nothing to do with Torah, per se, but one of the things I like about the sort of laid-back approach to Torah Tidbits in print, as well as Torah Tidbits on the internet, the website, as well as Torah Tidbits audio, is that I can talk Torah, I could talk baseball, I could talk humor, and it's all part of a pleasant life. With that introduction, I mentioned that we are announcing the coming of Rosh Chodesh Adar the first. Maybe next week I will spend more time talking about it, as Friday and the following day, Shabbat, will be Rosh Chodesh itself. But just briefly now to make a comment. In the time of Sanhedrin, past and future, there was Adar, and under normal circumstances, during the month of Adar, usually in the first part of the month, an announcement from the Sanhedrin was made that the following month will be Adar again. In fact, in some literature, you can find the two Adars referred to as Adar and Ve'Adar, and Adar. They also took on Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni, Adar Aleph and Adar Bet, but the fact is that there's really only one Adar, and in the time of Sanhedrin, under certain circumstances, which I'll talk more about next week in Mirat Hashem, another Adar followed Adar, rather than Nisan, in order to delay Nisan and the Pesach that is in it. In our fixed calendar, we know way in advance the pattern. It's a 19-year cycle, which is called the Lesser Lunar Cycle, the Machzor Halavana, or Hayareach, and it's 19 years, during which the 3rd, 6th, 8th, 11th, 14th, 17th, and 19th, 7 years out of 19, have a second Adar. And it is not a decision made by the committee from Sanhedrin each year. It is a pattern, in which case we know in advance what's coming now is Adar Rishon, or Adar Aleph, and what it will be followed by is Adar Sheni, and we push the special Haftarot of Shkalim and Zachor, Parah and Hachodesh, to the second Adar, leading into Nisan, and we push Purim into the second Adar, and what's left in Adar Rishon is a mark on the calendar called Purim Katan and Shushan Purim Katan, and we'll talk more about that as those dates approached. The fact of the matter, again, is we have a fixed, mathematically calculable calendar today, with no Sanhedrin. In the time of Sanhedrin, there is more variability and flexibility in the calendar, which is based on a human involvement to the process of proclaiming months and intercalating years. With all of that said, I would like to share with you a shiur I gave to a mini shiur or a midi shiur that I gave to the folders a short while ago. A side note, you pick up background noise. I was very pleased to get an email from someone who said, I don't mind the background noise. It gives a certain ambiance and flavor to the listening, and I hope that other people have that attitude, because it is a necessary thing on a tight schedule on a Thursday for me to be able to speak to the folders and record it while I'm speaking, so that I can put it in as part of the show, because I don't have the time on a Thursday afternoon to do both if they had to be totally independent. All of what I'm saying now I didn't say to the folders, obviously, but the bulk of the shiur coming up is straight out of that recording, and it involves certain aspects of Parshat Mishpatim. So enjoy, and whatever time we have left, we'll fill in some other Mishpatim tidbits. Oh yeah, I had mentioned earlier that the word in the Torah, I didn't say it like this, is HaMishpatim. There are five or six sedras, I'd have to think through the list in order to find them again, where the word Ha, the word starts with the definitive article Ha, the Hey HaYediyah, and it's sort of developed in practice not to say the Hey is part of the name of the Sedra. So we have the Book of Devarim and the Parsha of Devarim, even though the Torah says Ele HaDevarim, etc., etc., as I said, for about five or six etc's, one of which is HaMishpatim, Ve'ele HaMishpatim, and a lot of times the definitive article Hey, as well as the Vav HaChibur, the joining Vav, are significant. For example, Ve'ele HaMishpatim, Asher Tasim Lifnehem, this week's Sedra begins with a Vav, which links it to last week's Sedra, and the lead article, which you can read in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits, and I make reference to in the mini shiur that you're about to hear, as well as being able to find it on the internet. Our website is www.ttidbits.com, where you can find a large file which has every single thing, including the ads and Teulim and schedule, that is in the regular printed Torah Tidbits. There's a light version, which takes out some of the heavy graphics, making a much more manageable file, PDF also. There's an extra light version with text only, Torah content only. There's even a lighter file called text, which has the whole thing reduced to plain email kind of text. And the Parsha Pix is there as a JPEG, which is available for looking on the screen or downloading, as well as a Palm Pilot handheld device version of the text file, which is also downloadable, plus a couple of other files that you might find interesting. www.ttidbits.com. And let's get on now to the mini shiur given to the Torah Tidbits folders a very short while ago. There is no Sedra that really can be understood without Torah Sheba'al Peh. But there is no Sedra that has more Torah Sheba'al Peh on it than Mishpatim. As you look through Mishpatim, Mishnayot and Gemaras go through your mind, assuming that Mishnayot and Gemaras are in your mind someplace, and it's more than just explanation. It's the inability to understand anything without the oral law. I mean, just a tiny example, which somebody wrote in one of the articles in Torah Tidbits. Let's make it into a modern hypothetical situation. Person has an attack dog, and it gets away from the owner, and it kills somebody. The Torah says that if we were talking about a docile animal. Then there's monetary compensation to the best of the court's ability to determine how much. But that's it. The owner is not held responsible when a docile animal, goes wild and does damage. But an attack dog, or a dog with a reputation of being wild, is another story. The Torah says the animal is to be put to death, and also the owner, v'gam ba'alav yumat. Does that mean that it's a capital offense for the owner of the animal when the animal went and, I'm not talking about an animal that was ordered by the owner, kill. I'm talking about it happened. The answer is no, you don't put him to death. So what do you mean, v'gam ba'alav yumat, and also the owner shall die? Well, the Gemara explains that we're talking about din shamayim, some kind of heavenly judgment, and the Torah is using that term to emphasize the seriousness of how much a person has to protect others from his own animals and possessions, but it doesn't mean that you put him to death, even though that's the word. So why not say it in a clearer way? Because there's no better way to emphasize the responsibility that a person has, but to say in writing, v'gam ba'alav yumat, and the owner shall also be killed. And then the Torah Shebaal Peh is meant to explain what it means in this particular case. Maybe even a clearer example is the famous eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, etc., etc., which we have been slandered by the rest of the world, calling Judaism and Moses' Torah barbaric. And it doesn't mean that. And it never meant that. And when we explain what it means, it's not rabbinic legislation. It is the transmission of the oral law through the generations. Let me jump to something else. Here's a situation that comes out of a Mishnah. A owns a horse. B rents the horse from him for the purpose of pulling a plow. B lends the horse to C. C also borrows it to plow with it, which is the understanding the owner of the horse A had in the first place. And we're not talking about any kind of misuse of the animal. Again, A's horse, he rented it to B. B lent it to C. Overnight, in C's barn, the horse drops dead. Guy comes in the morning, and there's the horse dead. A borrower is responsible to compensate the person who lent it to him if the horse dies a natural death, except if it's in the process of working. If he was pulling the plow and the horse died, then he's not responsible to pay. But if it died in the barn overnight, he has to pay. Who lent it to him? B. So he pays B the value of the horse. B rented the horse from A. A renter is not responsible to compensate the owner if a horse died of its own in the barn at night. So the first opinion in the Mishnah is, this is what happens. C has to pay B, and B does not have to pay A. Sound fair to you? What's the problem? You're following? It's A's horse. B rented it from A and ends up getting the value of the horse in compensation from the fact that the borrower had to pay him. And the first opinion in the Mishnah is that it doesn't go back to A. It doesn't make what kind of sense? It doesn't make... Okay, the Gemara discusses that and says, obviously, we're talking about a case where A gave that permission. Because if he didn't, this would be a misuse of the rental horse, and B would have to compensate. So that's a good point that you raise about, can he just do that? The answer is no, not without permission. Under the technicalities of what's called the four shomerim, A is the owner of the animal, B is a socher, a renter, C is a shoel. A shoel is chayav, obligated to compensate in the case of meta kidarka, died of its own, and B, the renter, is not liable to pay for meta kidarka. If the animal were stolen, then C would have to pay B and B would have to pay A, because if you rent an animal and it's stolen, you're responsible for it. Because the assumption is when you rent something from someone, you're going to protect it. And therefore you're responsible. But meta kidarka, dying of its own, and we're not talking about negligence here. Let's get that out also. If C or B use the horse to pull heavy boulders in clearing a field, when the rental agreement was for a horse to pull a plow, the assumption being a normal field and the normal work that involved in a plow, and this, by the way, is very similar to today's rule of renting a car, where you're expected to drive it on paved roads. It says so on a label on the dashboard, and it's in your contract, that you are responsible for damage if you take it onto a dirt road, and you're not covered by insurance, and it violates the agreement, the rental agreement, because on a dirt road, the tires kick up all kind of rocks and pebbles that do damage to the underside of the car. So whatever we say about an ox or a donkey or a horse still goes for those animals today, and it goes for cars also. Different kind. Obviously, a modern Beit Din would have to decide how similar this particular case is to the classic cases in Mishnah and Gemara when they render a decision. Getting back to this Mishnah, A owns the animal. He rented it to B. B, with permission of the owner, lent it to C. C is obligated to pay B, and B is not obligated to compensate A.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Mishpatim.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio. We've been in the middle of a mini-shir to the folders on Parshat Mishpatim. Let's continue with that. Comes the second opinion in the Mishnah and says, no way that we are going to allow B to profit with A's animal. It's not fair. But the reason I'm telling you this Mishnah is because it's not fair is not enough. If the halachic technicalities, the legal technicalities of a borrower arrangement with someone who lends him, or a renter and the rentee, whatever, those technicalities exist. And if you want to be a, a softy, and you want to say, hey, this is not fair because A loses out, had it still been in B's possession, he would lose out also. If the animal died of its own, B doesn't have to pay for it. That's the whole point. So the logic, the cold logic to the first opinion in the Mishnah is the animal died of its own, a renter is not required to compensate for that. A loses out. The fact that B lent it, not rented it, but lent it to C, he gains. That second opinion, I forgot whose it is, says, no way, no how, is it proper that B should benefit monetarily and A should lose out. But I say before, and I say it again, that doesn't do it. You need more.
So sure enough, he comes up with more. Well, the Gemara comes up with more. How can we go along with that second opinion, which says C has to compensate A, when it doesn't fit the technicalities of the situation? The answer is based on what was asked before, and that is when it's with permission of A. If it was without permission of A, it would be a violation of an agreement. Therefore, it was with permission of A. When it's with permission of A, we can describe the situation that A assigned B as his agent, in Hebrew, shaliach, to lend it out. In other words, if we look at B purely as a renter, he doesn't have to compensate. But if we redefine this situation where the horse went to the third person as saying B acted in shlichut, in agency, for A, then C has to compensate A because it's his animal. And then it's not only logical, but it's also fair. You follow the idea. This happens now. There are situations in halacha, let's just drift off for a moment. There are situations in this kind of interpersonal business deals where something could not be fair, and the technicality is a technicality. You go to a store and you buy an object. You pay for it, but you say, I don't have my car with me. Let's say we're talking about a microwave oven. You pay for it, and you say, I'll be back tomorrow to pick it up. You never picked it up in your hands. It's still on the shelf, and the owner agreed. Whose is it? Who owns that microwave for the rest of the day and the first part of tomorrow? Why do I ask? Because at night they had a burglary and the microwaves were stolen, or a fire and they were burned.
He paid for it,
but he never picked it up. The question is, does paying money acquire it? Don't shake your head yes so quickly. Or physically taking it? The answer is, in movable chattel, it's called, metaltalin in Hebrew, money is not the act of kinyan. Money is payment for it. But the physical act of picking it up and taking it into your possession is the kinyan. So technically, even though you paid for it, he can't shrug and say, your microwave was stolen last night, sorry. He has to say, it was never yours yet, here's a microwave, or here's your money back. Real estate, money, since you can't pick up real estate and put it in the truck, except in the old Charlie Manor routine, where the funny routine, I hope I could find it someplace, where he's walking down the street and the guy goes, psst. Guy calls him over wearing a trench coat and a hat, you know, pulled over his eyes. Got something for you in the truck. What? Shh. Anyway, it turns out, what is it? Finland. So he was trying to sell him Finland. Anyway, if the guy had picked it up and not yet paid for it and said, can you hold it? I'll be back tomorrow. That's a different situation, because then it's his and the owner becomes a shomer chinam, and you have to go by those rules. The point is, you could read this in the Parsha, and then you just have to go to the Mishnah and the Gemara to see what's what on just about anything that's said. There are 53 mitzvot in Parshat Mishpatim. 53. That's a very big chunk of mitzvot. Not only that, there are a whole bunch more that aren't even counted here. They belong elsewhere, but they're mentioned here also, so it is a mitzvah-packed sedra. I feel very appropriately so, because it's the one that's teamed with Yitro. The lead tidbit is called the Siamese Twin Sedras, and even if you haven't read it yet, I want you to picture I mean, it's almost, it came to my mind in the form of joined at the hip kind of thing. But I want you to picture two objects that you bring together. They're not connected, they're just being brought together. But then they're all tied with rubber bands. Take a rubber band that's holding one side, one object, and stretch it over the other object too. And then do the same by stretching from there around there. And now you have the two objects, which are not only next to each other, but they are joined by the force of these bands that are around both of them. This is what happens in the Sedra. You could read it, but I'll tell it to you briefly now. The fact that Yitro, which has Matan Torah, the whole Revelation at Sinai episode, begins with a story that really belongs in Mishpatim. Yitro goes out in the morning to check on his son-in-law, maybe in today's terms, I want to see if I married off my daughter to a guy that makes a good living. So he watches what Moshe does, and he sees that he's burdened the entire day with people asking him questions, and he has to settle disputes. And he says, "My dear son-in-law, I have a suggestion for you." And we could say Moshe was nice enough to take it, but he wasn't. It was God who said, "Listen to Yitro." And therefore, you know, we don't know the kind of son-in-law Moshe would have been, although we do. In any event, the establishment of lower courts, monetary courts, and then capital courts, and the whole system of Sanhedrin really is right out of Eila HaMishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem, but it comes before Matan Torah, like that band that is stretched behind, before the episodes of Matan Torah in order to link them together. And then at the end of Mishpatim, I said it's filled with 53 mitzvot and a bunch more, but the end of Mishpatim is not with mitzvot, the last two aliyot. It continues the story of Matan Torah. So it's like a rubber band stretched from Yitro, and one of the things that I wrote is, ask the average fairly knowledgeable Jew, in what Sedra do we find the famous words Na'aseh v'nishma? And I would say most people will answer, must be in Yitro. It's not, it's in Mishpatim. The end part of the story of Matan Torah is in the end of Mishpatim. After all of the detail of everyday life, my dog dug up your roses, and your roses scratched my dog, and I have a bill from the vet. You have a bill from the florist to replace your rose bush. Who gets what, and how much, what kind of compensation, etc. The fact that there are different levels of damage. An animal damages things with its teeth by chewing something up. It damages by its feet by trampling something. And there are differences between it. And this whole concept of an animal that's expected or not expected to do damage, that makes the owner more or less culpable. Sure, I have a Siberian tiger, but I didn't think it would attack anybody. Obviously, you can't say that. But I have this cute little chihuahua, and it went and did damage that you would never even believe it capable of, so you're not going to be held totally responsible for it. The burden will be shared by the person who's damaged. On the other hand, if the court finds out from witnesses that this is the third attack of this chihuahua, and he has a reputation of being Doberman Pinscher wannabe, then you're going to be held responsible. And there are some animals, the Gemara says, are always considered dangerous, even if you train them and even if you domesticate them. Bear is one of them. You know, you picture the dancing bear in a circus. But a bear's nature is aggressive, and, you know, training just goes so far, and you really get him annoyed, and he'll forget his social graces. So I mean, that's just a little bit of scratching the surface, but there's so much in Mishpatim. Let me introduce one other area. It's interesting how it exists with the two forms of Shabbat. What forms of Shabbat am I talking about? The seventh day of the week, which is what we call Shabbat or Shabbos. And then there's the seventh year of a cycle, which we call Shemitah, which is also called Shabbat. In each case, the positive command to observe Shabbat and Shemitah are in Mishpatim. The prohibitions against doing Melacha for Shabbat are in Yitro. The prohibitions against violating Shemitah are in Bahar. So we see in these two examples, which are very similar conceptually, are pretty much the same kind of idea, the Torah separating a command to keep the special quality of that particular day or year, and then, as if to say, see elsewhere for the details. And that's instructive also. It's not together. Concept of Shemitah. How do I do it? What am I not allowed to do? Wait, you'll find that elsewhere. Right now, we're interested in the principle. The principle is Shnat Shemitah is Kodesh to God, and you can't do certain things. Shabbat is a day of rest, not a day of taking a nap, that we learn from someplace else, but a day of abstaining from melacha. Where is the prohibition? Happens to be in last week's Seder of Yitro as part of the Aseret HaDibrot, where it says, Lo ta'aseh kol melacha. Right now, in Mishpatim, the Torah was concerned in making it a positive command to keep Shabbat, even though the effect of it is technically the same. A person is not allowed to boil up water on Shabbat for tea. You do that, you're in violation of Lo ta'aseh kol melacha, and you are in non-fulfillment of Uvayom hashvi'i tishbot. Remember, or listen to the words, violation. I use that word when there's a prohibition. Thou shalt not, you did, you're in violation. As opposed to, in contrast with, non-fulfillment. You have to bench after a meal. If you don't, you are in non-fulfillment of the mitzvah to bench. If you don't eat matzah at the Seder, you are in non-fulfillment of the mitzvah. If you don't have a mezuzah on your doorpost, you are in non-fulfillment. If you speak Lashon Hara about someone, you are in violation of the prohibition of Lashon Hara. If you steal, you're in violation. If you eat non-kosher, you are in violation. If you desecrate the Shabbat, you are both in violation and in non-fulfillment of the positive command to rest on Shabbat. I've said before, I'll say it again, this concept of a positive command when we already have a prohibition. Another example is Yom Kippur. The Torah not only requires fasting, it forbids eating and drinking. Eating and drinking is the opposite of fasting. You eat and drink on Yom Kippur, you're not fasting. You fast on Yom Kippur, you're not eating and drinking. So what's going on here? The answer is that there's a prohibition against eating and drinking on Yom Kippur, and a person who does eat violates that prohibition. Not talking about with permission because of health. A person who fasts on Yom Kippur is simultaneously fulfilling a mitzvah taseh to fast on Yom Kippur, as well as non-violation of the prohibition. You have it with Shabbos, you have it with Yom Kippur, you have it with a whole bunch of things, but not always. And I think it's important to see that. When you eat non-kosher, you are in violation of a prohibition against eating non-kosher. There is not really a positive command to eat kosher. You have to eat kosher because you're not allowed to eat not kosher. There happens to be a positive mitzvah with kashrut also, but it's not that. It's really for checking the simanim to make sure that something is kosher before you eat it. So that exists also. But there are prohibitions that do not have a positive mitzvah on the other side, and when there is such a double, it bears understanding and repeating. The best way that I could say it, I got from a book called The Sabbath by Diane Grunfeld from England, Zichrono Livracha, a book that every Jew should have and should read once a year. It's a thin book, but a wonderful read for feeling good about keeping Shabbos. It's probably in the library, but it's a Kedai book to find if it comes back into print. It's been out and in and out and in a couple of times. Actually, in and out, in and out. What he says there about the positive command of abstaining from malacha is that this is the way that we take the creative activities which God endowed us with and we lay them in homage at his feet as the creator of the world and one who gave us the intellect to do these things. I don't care how great a sewer, knitter, or crocheter you are, that is an ability that comes originally from God. You could do it better than someone else, but God gives it. And that creative activity is on the list of activities that God said do not do on Shabbat. And therefore, when a person doesn't do it, it is not because he's cowering in the corner, afraid to violate what God said. That's Yirat Shamayim, which is fine. But it's more than that. It is a loving gesture on the part of the sewer, crocheter, knitter, embroiderer, needle pointer, hook rugger, or whatever. I said hook rugger, not rug hooker, but it is a gesture of ahavat Hashem, love of God, to say, I appreciate the fact that God created the world. Shabbat is a weekly reminder of it. We have daily reminders as well. Shabbat is a weekly reminder, and the way that I acknowledge is not while I'm crocheting, I say, this is for you, God. No. I put down my crocheting cotton and my needle and put it away for Shabbat and don't do it on Shabbat or even, Karen, Chol HaMoed. And this is a positive, loving gesture, albeit required by the Jew, to acknowledge the creative gifts that we receive from God. There's a lot of technicality here. Not every single thing that's creative is included in the prohibition of Shabbat. You can be very creative in the ability to make a pun. Let's assume, give it the honor of calling that creativity. You're allowed to make puns on Shabbos. I just, you know, took that off of the top of my head. There are things that you're allowed to do. But those things that you're not allowed to do, one of the helpful rhyme and reason to them, especially to the positive command, is that we are doing this in acknowledgement of God's creation and in appreciation for Him. When you stand up and make kiddush, or sit down and make kiddush, as the case may be, that too is an acknowledgement in God's creation of the world, in His taking us out of Egypt, and giving us Shabbat. But so is the abstention from the malacha. And you know something, I'll go one step further, which I haven't said before, and I'm feeling okay about it. I'm feeling okay about it. When we say Shomar v'zochar b'dibur echad, which Shomar comes from the version of the Aseret HaDibrot recorded in Vo'et Hanan, and Zachor comes from the version in Yitro. And we say that that brings together the positive commandments and the prohibitions of Shabbat, The usual way to understand that is Zachor includes things like making Kiddush and saying Havdalah. And Shamor is to preserve Shabbat from violation. And that's the negative side, the prohibition side. But I would say that Shamor is also to preserve Shabbat from violation by abstaining from Malacha. In other words, it has that positive side there. And that's part of the package deal of Shabbat. You should know also women are obligated on Kiddush because of the concept of Shamor v'Zachor b'Dibur Echad. Women are obligated on all the prohibitions of Shabbat because they are prohibitions, but you should also know that every single one has a flip side from this week's Sedra of Uvayom Hashvi'i Tishbot. There's a lot more, but I'll stop here. Time is almost up, so let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtamea.